GBW 1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay,
and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. Some Republican senators say they want to see the House Ethics Committee report into the Attorney General nominee Matt Gaetz. Sources tell ABC the report was set to be released before Gaetz resigned from Congress after he was tabbed as Attorney General by President-elect Trump. ABC's Mary Alice Parks says some of the medical community are also concerned over Trump's choice of Robert Kennedy Jr. as the health secretary.
Increased concern from the medical community about the nomination of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to lead the Department of Health and Human Services. The American Academy of Pediatrics writing that the nomination was an opportunity to share the settled science on vaccines with government leaders as well as the American public. Kennedy, of course, is a well-known vaccine skeptic.
President Biden will meet with Chinese leader Xi Jinping today in Peru. And federal prosecutors say Sean Diddy Combs is trying to obstruct justice from jail in his sex trafficking case. He has pleaded not guilty. This is ABC News. There were two incidents involving Southwest Airlines planes Friday. One flight had to be canceled after the plane was hit by a bullet before it took off from Dallas Love Field. Nobody was hurt. Then there was a fire on board a plane during boarding in Denver. ABC's Zareen Shah has more on that.
Passengers at Denver's airport forced to evacuate on slides after a cell phone battery caught fire.
A lot of people were just so panicked.
Catherine Rios was a few seats in front of the fire and says everyone suddenly was inhaling a lot of smoke.
Pretty much just kind of trapped.
Southwest Airlines saying the aircraft carrying 108 passengers was still at the gate when the battery caught fire Friday morning, causing the seat to catch fire from the burning phone. The passenger whose phone it was is being treated for burns, and another passenger suffered minor injuries while evacuating.
An attorney for Rudy Giuliani said the former mayor of New York turned over his car, several watches, and financial assets to two Georgia election workers he was found to have defamed. I'm Brian Clark.
I'm Lisa Hale with WGBW News. Your news in depth. Find it in the news section at WGBW.fm.
Matt Nair on air.
And we are here with Matt Randolph, Mr. Global. Donald Trump now will be coming in for a second term. There has been talk of removing sanctions from Russia. What would that mean, Matt, for the oil and gas industry?
So it depends on what Russia does, but we've seen nothing to suggest that they want to have anything to do with lowering oil prices.
And so the prices are essentially going to stay the same.
In all likelihood, yes.
Matt Nair on air. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
From the lakeshore to Lake Winnebago.
Door to Fond du Lac counties.
Northeast Wisconsin is special for many different reasons. I'm Lisa Hale.
And I'm Terry Barr. Family and fun.
Safe communities and friends. We're featuring all of it as part of New Wisco Weekend, a news magazine show just for you, and highlighting what makes the Fox Valley and Green Bay area a great place to live. Join us.
New Wisco Weekend, Saturday mornings at 8, Sundays at 11 on WGBW and WISS and the Civic Media app.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tomei Olson. More people across the country are driving electric vehicles, but Wisconsin lags behind. EVs only make up about 1% of all cars on our roads. Here's Judith Ruiz Branch.
Misconceptions about cost, maintenance, and performance are top of mind for hesitant buyers. But in Wisconsin, where about 30% of the state's population is rural, accessibility is one of the biggest concerns. Jeremiah Brockman with the Wisconsin Electric Vehicle Association thinks it's only partly because rural areas in general are slower to catch on to some trends. He says some areas still don't have enough charging stations.
Part of the problem, too, is you have more farmland in rural areas. And if you spend the entire day out on a farm and you're driving around your, you know, many acres of land, you worry about where you're going to charge your vehicle at that point. And I think that's another hurdle.
Compared to neighboring states, Wisconsin has significantly fewer charging stations. In an effort to help bolster the state's EV infrastructure, Wisconsin passed a law earlier this year to install a network of 65 fast charging stations statewide. The plan is to install them every 50 miles along the interstate system and major highways through next year. Even though the law was Republican-authored in Wisconsin, Brockman says he believes the political divide is another factor in EV ownership hesitation.
Honestly, you know, this is part of a larger national conversation where electric vehicles are kind of being politicized. And, you know, I like to say the benefits are there. It doesn't matter who you voted for last Tuesday. The benefits are there no matter what.
Those benefits include lower fuel and maintenance costs, lower emissions, and potential tax breaks. For Public News Service, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
And this is Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tomei Olson.
This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, look for mostly cloudy skies, a bit breezy, highs near 51. Some sprinkles or light showers tonight, a low around 43. Cloudy skies, breezy again for Sunday with a high near 55. On Monday, another chance of rain, otherwise partly sunny, 51.
Right now, 40 degrees.
Earl Ingram.
On the next show, it's Motown Monday, and we'll dive deep into why certain groups voted for Donald Trump and the direction of the future of our nation.
The Earl Ingram Show, weekday mornings at 9.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for Matt Nair on Air.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus, a law review, the second hour of our weekend broadcast. Glad to have you with me for this second hour. We're spending most of our time this weekend talking about the U.S. Department of Justice, what it does, what its mission is on behalf of you, the people of the United States of America, the role that the Attorney General plays in advancing, promoting, yes, broadly, the missions, the identified goals of the president, but not doing that in a way that identifies particular people, at least not up until now. That has not been the tradition, with, admittedly, a few little glitches here and there. And so we do all of this to help you understand in greater detail and encourage your further exploration of what it is the U.S. Department of Justice does. You can go online, type in the United States Department of Justice, Justice Department, DOJ, it'll all pop up, and you can identify in your particular area of interest specific information about what, for example, the Environment and Natural Resources Division does. What the Antitrust Division does, what the Criminal Division does, what the National Security Division does, what the DEA, the ATF, the FBI, all of them, what do they do inside the Department of Justice? What does the Community-Oriented Policing Services do? What does the Community Relations Service do? What does the Office of Justice Programs do? And why is all of that important? It's because the Attorney General is responsible for overseeing, managing, in many ways directing the operations of all of those various agencies and litigation-specific assignments inside the United States Department of Justice, not just at Main Justice, but also in the U.S. Attorney's offices and other offices in major cities around the country. It is not the case. Department of Justice is just out there in Washington, D.C. It's right here in Wisconsin, two major offices and lots of other satellite offices when it comes to the FBI, the DEA, the ATF, all these other investigative agencies inside the Department of Justice. And that's why it is so important to understand what the Department of Justice does in concert with appreciating and evaluating, assessing, as we all can and should do, the attempted nominees, the intended nominees of this president to occupy those positions. We know that just this past week, President-elect Donald Trump named former Representative Matt Gaetz, who has been a Republican representative from the state of Florida, as his nominee for attorney general. It is undeniably a provocative move. And installing at the helm of the United States Department of Justice somebody who may, in fact, be the person who accomplishes what Donald Trump has said that he is going to be. And that is retribution, your retribution, my retribution for things that have gone on in America. Those are his words. I'm going to be your retribution, he has said. And maybe, just maybe, that's the commission he's going to be giving to Matt Gaetz. We hope not. We hope that, consistent with the tradition of the Department of Justice, that this attorney general, if he is confirmed, will adopt and pursue that arm's length relationship and will not be retributive when it comes to who it is who's prosecuted, who it is who is on the receiving end of litigation. The pick undeniably identifies Matt Gaetz. He's 42 years old. He was the focus, significantly, as you probably know well, of a three-year federal investigation by the Department of Justice, by the FBI, the very agencies that he will now oversee, maybe, 2020, at the end of Donald Trump's first term. Justice Department and the FBI opened an investigation to claims that Gaetz, he is a sitting congressman at this time, was involved several years earlier with a minor, a young girl, 17 at the time. Investigators sought to determine whether Gaetz had effectively paid for sex in violation of federal sex trafficking laws. Always have to have a basis upon which to initiate an investigation. They plainly had it here. And they investigated this for about 3 years, ultimately concluding, probably because, reading the tea leaves on this, that for various reasons, the witnesses, including maybe the principal witness, the victim witness here, now well beyond 18, but at the time of making the decision, 18 years old, probably determining that she would not be a compelling witness, a maybe not even a believable witness when it comes to presenting a case to a grand jury and arguing that the government has proven its case beyond a reasonable doubt to a jury that would have to decide unanimously that they had met that burden. The Department of Justice determining in the end that perhaps while the events happened, not a sufficiently strong case against Matt Gaetz to bring that to a grand jury, to result in a grand jury indictment, to ultimately schedule a trial on those cases. And so never charged them. Matt Gaetz never charged for any of that in the federal system. Gaetz, of course, repeatedly said in the media he did nothing wrong, denied emphatically that any of these charges were true. Promised to fight back if indeed there was an indictment. There never was. And so the case itself was not prosecuted formally by the Department of Justice, closed after 3 years. But that's not to say that other things have not happened here. Plainly, Gaetz has also been under investigation by a parallel group. They're not responsible for prosecuting, but that group is the House Ethics Committee. Member of the House of Representatives, subject to ethics oversight by the House Ethics Committee. That about since 2021, that case, House investigators, by all reports, were looking into similar allegations, sexual misconduct, maybe illicit drug abuse and use, all those things, again, in violation of federal law, but just more generally conduct that may be in opposition to the standards set forth for people who are representing us in the United States Congress. Allegations there also about sharing inappropriate images or videos on the House floor. That's a part of the focus, according to a lot of reporting about what the House Ethics Committee has been looking at. Arguably misusing some state identification records. Likewise, in his role as a United States representative, converting campaign funds to his personal use, all of those things that may or may not have also been a part of the Department of Justice investigation that resulted in no prosecution. But the subject of parallel investigative work by the House Ethics Committee and its staff. And we know well that the House Ethics Committee was planning to release a critical report on all of that as late as this past Friday. Just this past Friday, announcing that it's going to be having a hearing on Capitol Hill, announcing, releasing this report of what it thought would be a sitting member of the House of Representatives, Matt Gaetz. In fact, a couple of days before that, in Wednesday of this past week, as we all know, the president-elect of the United States of America announced that Matt Gaetz would be his nominee for the chief federal law enforcement officer for the United States of America. And almost contemporaneous with that, Matt Gaetz resigned from the House of Representatives, bringing his term of service to the people of Florida to an end there in the United States Congress, effectively under House rules, bringing to an end also the jurisdiction that House Ethics Committee has over him. And so the hearing never happened late this past week. The report was never released. We do not know what it would have said, at least not yet. There have been great calls, as you also know, from the public, from the media, from maybe members of the population generally as well, maybe you among them, calling for the release of this report for a couple of reasons. One, the information generally significant to know, a former government employee whose conduct plainly was the focus of a federal investigation, a criminal investigation, also the focus of an ethics non-criminal. Nobody goes to jail as a result of the House Ethics Committee report. Had it been released, had the committee moved forward on it, they may have sanctioned a member. They may have done other things to tell him, we do not approve, we sanction, we do not condone what you have done, and could apply House rules. None of that involving criminal convictions or time in prison. But there is interest out there in all of this, heightened hugely by the fact that there may be and certainly appears to be a huge amount of interest in the other branch, the other chamber of the Congress. That's the United States Senate. Why? Because now, as a result of the announcement of Matt Gaetz as Donald Trump's nominee, now we know that the Senate committee, the Senate Judiciary Committee, in addition to the House work in the ethics area, the Senate Judiciary responsible for determining whether or not to recommend the confirmation of Matt Gaetz to the full Senate. The Senate, under its advise and consent responsibility, the Article 1 of the Constitution of the United States of America, also implicit in Article 2, the executive branch, the president nominates, the Senate confirms or not under an advise and consent authority, and planning, presumably, to have that hearing with respect to the nomination of Matt Gaetz. Is it relevant for that Senate committee now to have that report from the House Ethics Committee? I would offer absolutely yes. It is information being held by a group of people literally right down the hall in that same building, the Capitol building of the United States of America. You can walk down the hall from one side of the Senate side of the Congress to the House side, and you can pick up that report plainly. It's in electronic form, can get it easily. Is it relevant for members of the United States Senate determining whether or not this candidate for the position of attorney general, determining whether or not that candidate is qualified to have that report? That report that, again, is not an indictment. It is a report of the summary of the investigative work done by the House in these various areas. I would argue that it's hugely important. And indeed, senators on both sides of the political aisle are this weekend and previously asking for that report. Significantly, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, his name is Mike Johnson, has said, nope, not giving it to you. The House Ethics Committee work in this area is done. The issue probably not done, probably not resolved. The issue is certainly not going away, especially as the nomination continues to move maybe toward some Senate review. Again, mentioning this notion of a possibility of a recess appointment, which would prevent the Senate from doing its advise and consent process in a routine way. Maybe a story for the coming days to be resolved. But the issue of Matt Gaetz, the nomination of him, and the interplay with his past history, at least suggesting that he may have violated federal law, the very federal laws that he will be obligated to enforce, overseeing agencies that have investigated him, overseeing the very agency that was the recipient of this information about his arguably illegal conduct. We hasten to add, as we always do, no conviction, no finding of guilt here. That happens only if a jury determines guilt beyond a reasonable doubt after a trial, not here, but appropriate, because this process is not a criminal process. It's a political process. And Matt Gaetz should be the subject of Senate review. As Amicus Law Review continues, we'll talk about the other nominees being presented by the president-elect to the American people and to the Senate for consideration inside the Department of Justice.
The Talk of Green Bay, WGBW.
Doctors Without Borders is delivering life-saving medical care where it's needed most in communities around the world. From bandaging war-wounded patients in Sudan to providing clean drinking water in Haiti, we're in more than 70 countries worldwide, bringing patients from sick to recovering, from emergency to aid, from crisis to care. This life-saving care is made possible by a global movement of supporters like you. Thank you.
The Dom Salvia Show.
State Senator-elect Jody Habesh-Sinikin. What's the best way, do you think, it is to approach a difference in not just opinion, but in what we perceive as facts with those that may not be aware or don't agree with it?
First, having a conversation. Try to get an understanding of what is really bothering them and try to offer solutions at the state level or at the local level where there can be progress.
The Dom Salvia Show. Weekdays from 4 till 6 on the Civic Media Radio Network and on the Civic Media app. From Hobart to Bay Settlement, 97.9 WGBW.
My name is Jim Santel. This is Amicus a Law Review. Talking today in this special version of Amicus, all about the Department of Justice, interfacing now with these decisions by the president-elect to appoint various people, including Matt Gaetz, to the highest position of law enforcement in our land, the attorney general position. Matt Gaetz, not a lot, if any, litigation experience, spending most of his time recently in the United States Congress. Matt Gaetz, the nominee, nonetheless, by the president-elect to occupy this major position, do not have to be present employees of the Department of Justice to be nominated for these positions. It is not the case. You have to rise through the ranks. Many people do. Janet Reno, for example, not a part of the federal Department of Justice, but the attorney general, or rather the district attorney for many years in Florida, Dade County, doing a lot of work there in the area of law enforcement. A prosecutor understands the policies and the principles of a prosecutor, understands litigation, both civil and criminal. And so when Bill Clinton many years ago tapped her to become the attorney general, coming in from the outside, but she knew about the basic processes of the Department of Justice, an active lawyer in court. And so questions plainly beyond his immediate past history, whether or not he qualifies based upon arguably unproven, but nonetheless somewhat evidentiary support for this notion that he was engaging in some kinds of criminal activity, whether that qualifies him or disqualifies Matt Gaetz from being in that position. Other questions about simply your capacity to oversee this huge organization in all these areas that we talked about a couple of segments ago. In that same category, the president-elect has also nominated three people in other positions that we've also not now just talked about: the deputy attorney general, the principal associate deputy attorney general, the PADAG, kind of the chief of staff for the deputy attorney general, and also the solicitor general of the United States of America, the person sort of fourth in command who charges and goes forward with cases in front of the Supreme Court, argues to the Supreme Court on behalf of the people of the United States of America, the positions adopted by and advanced by the administration. And so who are those other people? Well, the other three that the president-elect has nominated are all in the category of people who serve presently as his private attorneys who have represented him, two of them in the criminal cases that are still pending against him, and one of them in other matters as well. Let's talk about them one by one. Todd Blanche, B-L-A-N-C-H, a lawyer who oversaw Donald Trump's criminal defense in at least three of these criminal indictments, these three criminal cases. He's tapped to become the number two position in the Department of Justice, the deputy attorney general. He is a former prosecutor in Manhattan, so he has that background. He is a trial attorney. He's a defense attorney. And so he's got those kinds of good credentials. He knows what he's doing. He's been inside a courtroom. He has also been, along with another nominee, he's formerly an assistant United States attorney in the Southern District of New York. He has been inside the Department of Justice before for that very reason. And along the way, of course, the history now is that Todd Blanche has represented Donald Trump not only in general matters, but also in that case that is going to take some headlines again this coming week. We know that this coming week on Tuesday, if he keeps to his calendar, Judge Juan Merchan is going to be announcing his decision on whether or not that Supreme Court case involving immunities for a president applies to the criminal prosecution, the criminal conviction that our president-elect suffered way back in May, finding that he violated 34 different instances of New York law. In that matter, Todd Blanche has represented Donald Trump. Now, you may say, well, gee, got a verdict there by a unanimous jury, beyond a reasonable doubt, that Donald Trump was guilty, but represented him effectively, advocated for his position there in court, and also stood by him as he did those impromptu, or maybe not so impromptu, press conferences outside the Manhattan Criminal Court. Todd Blanche representing Donald Trump in that case, and presumably will represent him going forward in the days just ahead, not only as Juan Merchan announces his opinion, but also on schedule to sentence Donald Trump, Todd Blanche's client, Donald Trump, on November 26, right before Thanksgiving. That is also on the schedule. Todd Blanche scheduled to appear with his client, Donald Trump, in those dates coming up here in November. Todd Blanche also named by his client, the future president of the United States of America, to be Donald Trump's deputy attorney general. We'll get back to that in just a moment or so. The president-elect has also identified a couple of other people. Emile Bove, B-O-V-E, who has also served next to Todd Blanche at those counsel tables in those criminal cases, including the case in New York in which Donald Trump is found guilty of those New York offenses. He has been nominated. He has been identified as the principal associate deputy attorney general, basically the chief of staff, if you will, to the deputy attorney general, has a huge amount of administrative responsibility inside the Department of Justice, again, for overseeing, managing the department, as does the deputy attorney general. Very important, a right-hand, a left-hand person right there. Again, according to all of the organizational structure of the Department of Justice historically and anticipated for this administration, anticipating that will happen, Emile Bove, this coming week and next week, sitting next to his client, Donald Trump, in that New York courtroom, as he has done in other settings in which Donald Trump has been charged with criminal offenses, sitting next to his client, who will become the president of the United States of America, now indicating that he is going to identify and nominate and place in the position of the paydag, the attorney who is in part representing him in those cases. His name, Emile Bove. And then we've got a third one. His name is D. John Sauer, S-A-U-E-R. He has not been representing the president, the future and past president, in connection with these criminal cases, but he did represent Donald Trump before the Supreme Court in arguing what? That the former president was entitled to these broad immunities. And indeed, Mr. Sauer was successful, right, in convincing the Supreme Court that Donald Trump should be immune from prosecution, at least presumptively immune for many things, and absolutely immune for the engagements with the U.S. Department of Justice. John Sauer representing Donald Trump, who is now appointing him to the position of Solicitor General of the United States of America. John Sauer representing him in that case, also representing Donald Trump on the appeal of the E. Jean Carroll sex assault defamation case, that matter now in appeal. He worked for Josh Hawley for many years when Josh Hawley was the attorney general in the state of Missouri. He was also a clerk to Antonin Scalia. All three of these trial attorneys, all three of these people who know their way around the courtroom, all three of them plainly, with respect to some aspects of the cases against Donald Trump, successful. We know that at least those two other cases, the case in Mar-a-Lago, the case involving election interference in the District of Columbia, those will almost certainly go away. Those will not see the light of day. And to the extent that Todd Blanche and Emile Bove and others were responsible for the strategy that promoted the delay in those, they have been successful. And Donald Trump, their future boss as the president, will benefit from that legal counsel, that legal advice for years to come. When we continue, some more discussion about why those issues should be on your mind as we think about the nominees going forward for the Department of Justice here in the United States of America.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home of Mino and the Mayor.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. Some Republican senators say they want to see the House Ethics Committee report into the Attorney General nominee Matt Gaetz. Sources tell ABC the report was set to be released before Gaetz resigned from Congress after he was tabbed as Attorney General by President-elect Trump. ABC's Mary Alice Parks says some in the medical community are also concerned over Trump's choice of Robert Kennedy Jr. as the health secretary.
Increased concern from the medical community about the nomination of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to lead the Department of Health and Human Services. The American Academy of Pediatrics writing that the nomination was an opportunity to share the settled science on vaccines with government leaders as well as the American public. Kennedy, of course, is a well-known vaccine skeptic.
President Biden will meet with Chinese leader Xi Jinping today in Peru. And federal prosecutors say Sean Diddy Combs is trying to obstruct justice from jail in his sex trafficking case. He has pleaded not guilty. This is ABC News.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
A huge win for Wisconsin. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. Men's college basketball, the Badgers honored their Final Four team from 10 years ago, and Hall of Fame coach Bo Ryan then went out and beat number 9th-ranked Arizona, 103-88. Head coach Greg Gard.
Coach Ryan having the banner raised, and then how these guys played. I was most proud of the response when it was 65-all. That showed me the guts and the toughness that is starting to develop with this group, and it's a good step in the right direction.
College football tonight, the Badgers host Oregon at 6:30. NFL, Packers and Bears at noon tomorrow in Chicago. The team hoping for the return of rookie running back Marshawn Lloyd, out 2 months with an ankle injury. Offensive coordinator Adam Stenovich.
Yeah, I can't wait to get him back in the fold. Obviously, his explosive potential, his quickness.
So why wasn't Lloyd at practice Friday?
You can't make this stuff up. Unfortunately, he had appendicitis. So, you know, it's a shame.
That's Matt LaFleur with sports. I'm Mike Clemens.
Do you hear that? Asthma triggers are everywhere, from dust mites, pet dander, and pollen, to smog and smoke. And asthma.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, look for mostly cloudy skies, a bit breezy, highs near 51. Some sprinkles or light showers tonight, a low around 43. Cloudy skies, breezy again for Sunday with a high near 55. On Monday, another chance of rain, otherwise partly sunny, 51.
Right now, it's 44.
Hi, this is Jim Schmidt, your former mayor of Green Bay. You know, I've always cared about local issues. I still do. Join me on my new show, Lean Local, here on WGBW. I'll interview community leaders and elected officials, discuss the economy and development projects, and we'll talk about the future of education here in Greater Green Bay. As they say, all politics is local. So join me for Lean Local, Sunday at 1 p.m. on the Talk of Green Bay, 97.9 WGBW.
It's the sound of a soda, considered one of the coolest things made in Wisconsin. Jolly Good has been around since the 1960s. Cryer Foods makes it in Random Lake, which is in Sheboygan County. But Cryer started as a canning company in 1913. What was being canned there? Sauerkraut? Peas? Beets? The answer coming up.
At Jolly Good, we believe in quality.
Soda turned into an important revenue stream when production at the canning company slowed in the colder months. So what was being canned there? Sauerkraut, peas, beets? All three, plus juice, soups, and more. By the 1960s, Cryer quit canning and went all in on Jolly Good soda.
For flavor and value, Jolly Good's got it.
The latest resurgence of Jolly Good makes it a slice of Wisconsin for yesterday and today. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
The Todd Alba Show.
Brady joining us live via phone.
I tell the guys before every game, and honestly try to do it before every practice, challenge is going to come. This team is not just going to show up and allow us to walk all over them and win. Really what matters is how are we going to respond to that. Man, if you can adapt and use it as a learning opportunity, it's going to set you up to go accomplish darn near anything you want to.
I think there are a lot of people that need to hear that message today.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekdays, noon till 2. On your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Maggie Dawn.
Next, I'll be joined by Tom Moore from the Center for American Progress Action Fund. We'll discuss Trump's personnel selection process and recess appointments. Don't miss it.
The Maggie Dawn Show, weekday afternoons from 2 till 4.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, and we are spending most of our time in this weekend broadcast talking about the U.S. Department of Justice and considering the merits, the demerits of the applications, the proposals by the incoming president-elect to place in various positions inside the Department of Justice, positions of great responsibility and authority affecting your life and mine, the lives of everybody that you know. In these positions, various individuals, including Matt Gaetz, the now former representative from Florida, question about whether his qualifications generally require a further review by the United States Senate. The answer to that should be yes, they should definitely review it. Question whether or not they should pass favorably upon that nomination, whether the Senate Judiciary Committee should endorse that, whether the Senate itself should confirm him if indeed that comes to pass. We know that the president has also identified others outside of Maine Justice, outside of the Justice Department, Tulsi Gabbard to be the Director of National Intelligence, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to be the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Pete Hegseth to be the Secretary of Defense, others out there raising similar concerns about whether or not their backgrounds, their recent histories, the things they have said about the very organizations that they will be supervising and the subject matters of those agencies, whether that sort of makes them unqualified or more accurately anti-qualified for those positions. The assumed nomination going forward of Matt Gaetz, subject to that important review under the Constitution by the United States Senate, many of them saying already that they may not vote for him, but nonetheless embracing the process. We'll see what happens there. Also embracing the process for Donald Trump's other nominees in those other areas and other positions inside the Department of Justice, including Todd Blanche for the number two position, Deputy Attorney General, Emile Beauvais as the Principal Associate Deputy Attorney General, and John Sauer to be the Solicitor General, the person who argues cases before the Supreme Court. Now, they are all qualified as lawyers. They're all qualified as prosecutors, some of them obviously inside the Department of Justice. They practice in private practice as they do now. They know their way around a courtroom. And indeed, one has to say that Todd Blanche and Emile Beauvais and other members of their team have been successful in representing Donald Trump in at least two, if not more, of those cases. Two of those cases, the federal cases, will never see the light of day. They have been successful through the delays that they have accomplished by raising these issues of immunity and other things in keeping Donald Trump from going to trial. Almost certainly, one way or another, those cases will go away in the next several weeks. And so successful lawyers, and do not in any way mean to indicate that their aggressive and effective advocacy is something to be critical of. Just the opposite. Defense attorneys are incredibly important to our system. Here's the concern, and is the concern that my former colleague, Barbara McQuaid, who was, when I was U.S. Attorney in Eastern Wisconsin, she was the U.S. Attorney in Detroit in Eastern Michigan. Barbara McQuaid recently said that as to these other three, it doesn't bode well. It doesn't bode well, and I would embrace that classification as well. Three reasons why. And again, subject to your own assessment, my opinions, my views, based upon the nominees and the roles that they would play inside the U.S. Department of Justice. Number one, simply the appearance of awarding your personal private attorneys with great jobs. These are important positions. They're also positions of great notoriety and esteem and regard. For all Americans, simply looking at this appears to be a big thank you. I will give you a job inside my administration for keeping me out of prison, for keeping these cases at bay, and on a very superficial but important level, it simply strikes me, and I suspect many people, as simply the appearance of impropriety that a president is now turning around and appointing his attorneys, his private attorneys, to positions inside government because he can, and saying to them, thank you for doing the job well of keeping me out of prison. Now you get a government job. Not nepotism. They're not related to him. This is not like appointing your son-in-law or your daughter to positions inside the White House. But it does have that appearance. And that raises the second issue about the relationship. We know plainly from all the reporting that at least John Blanche and Emile Beauvais and others had to have a very close relationship with Donald Trump during all of this. They also had a close attorney-client relationship We'll get back to that in just a moment or so. And in that connection, plainly huge amount of communications between them, a relationship undeniably that is legal in nature, that is professional in nature. We don't know if it's personal with a capital P or a small p, but plainly a unique connection between Blanche and Beauvais and the future president of the United States of America. If indeed Donald Trump tends to make good on his promise to engage in retribution, I am your retribution, he has said. It may well be that Matt Gaetz will be the person who accomplishes that generally. The people to whom you call in Washington, D.C., inside Maine Justice, if that's your goal, those are the attorney general, the deputy attorney general, the PAYDAG. It's these various people who have had this very close relationship with Donald Trump during the time of their representation of him in these various settings. Those are the people that the president calls, picks up the phone and says, do this. And in so doing, abrogates and destroys what we have talked about previously here this weekend and so many other times, abrogates that arm's length relationship. The fact that they have had this relationship, continue to have it to this day, presumably into next week and the weeks ahead as the sentencing goes ahead in New York, other things happen with respect to those criminal cases. That relationship is so close that one wonders if the arm's length relationship that should be established between the White House and the Department of Justice could in any way exist when they already have a very close personal relationship. I always speak about the non-relationship that Bill Clinton had with Janet Reno. They didn't like each other very much, and that was a good thing. Here you've got just the opposite. Is it too close for the connection, the arm's length connection, admittedly, but the connection between the White House and the Department of Justice to be appropriate and not to encourage the kinds of directives that a president could do with respect to specific kinds of prosecutions against rivals, specific people filing civil lawsuits against them, no separation of just a relationship nature. That's the second reason why my colleague and I, Barbara Quaid, say this doesn't bode well. And the third one is kind of wonky. And it's really inside that representation issue. And we don't know a lot about, we will never know anything about the nature of the communications between Donald Trump and his attorney. But we do know that there was an attorney-client relationship there. We know with absolute certainty that Donald Trump, protected by the attorney-client relationship now and for all time, unless there is some rare exception, some crime-fraud exception that breaks into it, but unlikely here, unlikely. We know that Donald Trump told his attorneys, Todd Blanche, Mr. Beauvais, others in his team, things of a confidential nature. We don't know what those are. We don't know if they were admissions. We don't know if they were denials. We don't know what kinds of things he may have said about things related to the case in New York, those other cases in South Florida, the other case in Washington, D.C., the interference case. We don't know the content. We don't know what kinds of things the present and future and past president may have said to his attorneys, cloaked by, shielded by the attorney-client privilege, never to be disclosed. But they know things. They plainly know things about the man, the individual who's going to be occupying the West Wing and the White House and the Oval Office in particular. What if Donald Trump disclosed to them something in that confidential relationship? We don't know what. Wildly speculative on my part, I recognize that somehow becomes relevant, somehow becomes important to their work. Now, not as his counsel, but as operational people responsible for the Department of Justice, as the heads of the Department of Justice representing you, representing the people, no longer the person who's occupying the presidency, their former client. What if they know something that at some point becomes relevant? What if the president says or does something that prompts them to remember something that they told him, that he told them? In the context of that attorney-client relationship that presents maybe, possibly a conflict of interest that probably only they will know about, something the president does that they look at and say, gee, that's different from what he told us in the client relationship. That's contrary to what we know about what he admitted to us, what he said to us, what he confided us while we were his attorneys. And then they have a conflict of interest. The conflict is just that they cannot disclose that. And at the same time, they're responsible to represent what your interests, the interests of the Department of Justice, the interests of the rule of law, and cannot disclose the things that they know maybe could be important to the administration of the Department of Justice. That's the concern. That's the not bode well part of this. Again, wildly speculative, but that's the kind of thing that the members of the Senate, members of the population at large, should be looking at in determining whether or not even these folks, the other three, are they qualified as lawyers? Sure they are. They've been prosecutors. They've been inside courtrooms. They've argued cases to the Supreme Court. Sauer himself knows well the inside and outside of the Supreme Court. Is he qualified to take on the role that Ted Olson took on during the Bush administration? That Elizabeth Perlegar right now is doing so exceptionally well? Of course he is. The question is whether that appointment raises these concerns about appearances that you have of an incoming president appointing his former defense attorneys, the attorneys who've represented him in these appellate proceedings. Does that strike you as problematic? And I would suggest to you that it should. And certainly should suggest to the members of the Senate who are looking at this that they need to ask questions, not breaching the attorney-client relationship. That would be inappropriate. But nonetheless, inquiring about whether or not that's a concern, not disclosing the information, but concern among these nominees. Very clear, of course, anticipating a question here that none of these attorneys can continue to represent the sitting president in his private capacity once they become and they encumber these various positions like deputy attorney general, like the PAYDAG, like solicitor general. They cannot continue to represent him in any matters that may continue during his presidency, including those state cases, those state criminal matters in Georgia and certainly in New York as that goes up on appeal very lightly. Cannot do that. No one would permit that to happen. The president might like them to do so because they've been successful in accomplishing what he wanted them to do, but that cannot happen. But the issue is that prior representation. And with respect to Matt Gaetz, it is the prior investigative results not resulting in an indictment. The other information that's inside that report, all of that should come to the Senate Judiciary Committee in the times just ahead. They should conduct their hearings. They should not approve any of these people, including for many of the other positions for assistant attorneys general around the Department of Justice. No U.S. attorneys appointed by recess appointments, absent a review, in some ways big or small, by the Senate Judiciary Committee. We've got to approach this in the ways that James Madison contemplated we would do it, advise and consent of the Senate. That's the way that should happen. The American people should push back on this notion that recess appointments should be accomplished in a way that robs the United States Senate of the capacity to ask these questions of the Matt Gaetzes of the world, of the Tulsi Gabbards, of the RFK Juniors, of the Pete Hegseths, and of the many other nominees, thousands of them, candidly, that are going to come before the Congress for approval or rejection in the days, weeks, months, and years ahead. All of that happening, of course, as we anticipate the coming time. We have talked at great length about the nominations and the Department of Justice. We have also talked about the Supreme Court and the connection between the Office of the Solicitor General and the Supreme Court, the fact that there is indeed going to be a change in that position, whether or not John Sauer is confirmed. There will be a change in administration and a change in the ways in which the Department of Justice, through that Office of the Solicitor General, advocates before the Supreme Court. We're going to talk more about the effects of a new Solicitor General, a new administration, upon the present term that has before it a great number of cases, 45 as of this weekend, in a great number of areas, environmental cases, commerce cases. There's that major transgender case coming up for argument in December. We have also already had the argument involving firearms in America, the case involving the future of a DEA, of an ATF regulation. As we continue, we'll talk more about that and also other cases involving the United States Supreme Court here on Amicus, a Law Review.
.9 WGBW and WGBW.FM.
Hey there, it's Carrie Joy with your Work Buddy Minute and an answer to the question, how often should I take my car in to get it serviced? As somebody who's worked on cars and knows a little bit about them, I admit that my instincts here are 100% wrong. I always want to say, oh, I'll just know when it's time. I'll feel it. But that's pretty hard to make a plan or a budget around. And my husband has made an honest car owner out of me by scheduling our maintenance on the calendar according to the book that everybody has and nobody reads, the manual in your glove compartment. Yep, even the motorheads over at CarTalk.com, remember that old Car Talk radio show that was one of my favorites, you know, with Click and Clack, the Tappet Brothers? They say that taking your car in on the schedule dictated by the people who made it is the best way to keep it in shape. So grab that manual. And if you want more tips on saving, head over to workmoney.org. Till next time, I'm Carrie Joy saying take good care.
From Denmark to De Pere, this is 97.9 WGBW.
This is Amicus, a law review, as always, inviting your questions and your inquiries into our discussion this weekend, no exception to that. Mark, you've been on the line for a long time. Glad to have you with us this weekend on Amicus. Your question, your comment, your observation.
Yeah, it's amazing to me that Donald Trump, you know, is going out for retribution now, and clearly thinking about it logically, if indeed the Biden administration had been going after Donald Trump in retributive fashion, Donald Trump would be in jail right now. I mean, if he would have unleashed the full power of law enforcement upon Donald Trump and his allies, they would currently be in jail or detained someplace unpleasant. That what is remarkable to me is that Donald Trump supporters are going full along with one of the things that we broke with England for, is that basically under English code of justice, I mean, the king just said, judges, do this for me, and it was done. I mean, they right. served at the king's pleasure. That corruption in office has been anathema to justice or to government going back to antiquity. I mean, the story I've mentioned before is the case of Ximenes and Cambrus II, when Cambrus II found out that his judge, Ximenes, was taking bribes, he had the man executed in a most unpleasant fashion. That how a Supreme Court, the sophistry that they have engaged in to allow, you know, calling bribes now their gratuities, and to say that a president is immune when clearly the founders they rejected the idea of presidential immunity wholeheartedly, because that was one of the fears that the Anti-Federalists proposed, that they would just establish a monarchy here, and we cannot have that.
Absolutely.
That's
the key. And frankly, as you know well, Mark, that's exactly what at least the dissenters in that immunity case said. Sonia Sotomayor saying, again, we've got a loaded gun sitting there in the Oval Office ready to go off. And arguably, again, she wasn't speaking about the specific physical use of a weapon, although she did present some options now that a president would have as the king, some of which you have made reference to historically. She ended her piece saying, I'm fearful for democracy. And I take it away take from your comments this weekend that's your concern as well. And so, Mark, appreciate very much the comments and the historical perspective, which, again, prompt us all to think about the incoming administration, how it's going to handle these newfound powers, and specifically through the people put in positions of responsibility. Mentioned before, of course, that the Solicitor General is one of those people going to be encumbering the office of the Solicitor General inside the Department of Justice. Why is that important? The position of Solicitor General not only argues but also articulates in memorandums and briefs positions of the administration. There are two cases pending right now before the Supreme Court that will almost certainly be changed in the 65 days or maybe 70 days or so yet ahead, 65 days before Donald Trump takes the oath of office, and presumably some of these folks move through the process. One of those cases called Scrimeti. It's a transgender rights case. It's a challenge brought by the Biden administration to a Tennessee law that bans medical treatments for transgender minors. Scheduled to be argued right now, still in December next month. And the law also challenged a separate lawsuit by families and a doctor. The justices granted only the Biden administration's petition in that case to be reviewed. Trump administration, with the new Solicitor General coming in, will almost certainly reverse course. And the court will sooner or later have to make adjustments if it decides the constitutionality of the law, a dramatic impact upon one of the major cases of this term based upon what the American people have decided, the change in the Solicitor General then that comes from that, and a change in the advocacy about transgender rights in America. Here's the other one that we've talked about. We have talked about this case called Garland versus Vanderstock. It's the case on ghost guns, argued in October. The Supreme Court seemingly awfully supportive of the ATF regulation that says, yep, we can regulate these things. You can get them through the mail, you can order them, and you can put them together. Yes, it's appropriate to have serial numbers on them. Appears that the Supreme Court was headed in the direction, haven't decided it yet, of supporting the DEA regulation that permits regulations of ghost guns and the manufacturers of that. Trump administration could remember that moot, rescinding the regulation, changing the very underpinnings for the case itself. And, of course, that would change the geography not only of firearms in America, but the advocacy that goes on there in the Supreme Court. Many, many other instances, 45 other cases right now pending in front of the Supreme Court as of this week. Not all of them involve government interests, but many of them do. They just this past week granted certiorari in a number of other cases, things important to know, cases involving environmental issues. Oklahoma versus EPA, originating from the 10th Circuit, concerns whether the EPA has its final action under the Clean Air Act, where you challenge that kind of thing. Another case, EPA versus Calumet Shreveport Refining, concerns whether the Court of Appeals in the District of Columbia must be the venue for the claims of a small oil refinery. Some challenges there. Both of those things happening with respect to environmental cases. The Clean Air Act implicated by that, a thing called the Renewable Fuel Standard Program. Those cases are pending before the Supreme Court right now. They are newly welcomed, if you will, into the group of cases. The Supreme Court will decide. All of those, like many others, are also positions, cases in which the government has taken positions in favor of the EPA rules and the EPA positions. Will the new Solicitor General coming in about 65 days or so, or maybe shortly thereafter, reverse the positions of the present administration and abandon the EPA's position in favor of clean air and clean water and all the other environmental cases? A case recently given cert again in the Supreme Court called Louisiana versus Calais concerns the congressional map that the Louisiana legislature adopted in 2024. Now, that case probably not involving the federal government, but nonetheless, a case where if there is a related interest of the Department of Justice, of the government generally, we have seen this in all of the other gerrymandering cases, right? Many other situations where the U.S. Department of Justice has weighed in on these kinds of things. Many other cases out there. Cases argued just this past week. Velazquez versus Garland having to do with, again, an immigration issues, involuntary departure of immigrants under our federal system. A case called Delegati, which was also argued just this past week, involving minimum mandatory prison sentences. That's in a case involving the government centrally. The Solicitor General involved directly in that case, arguing before the Supreme Court just this past week. And another case involving securities fraud, likewise, of just this past week. All of those cases implicating the U.S. Department of Justice in deciding the positions of the Department of Justice. As we continue next week and in the weekends ahead, more discussion, more analysis of all of these things going to the rule of law, going to courts, and going to the administration of justice in our nation in 2024, 2025, and the times ahead. Have a good weekend, everybody.
This is the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW. John Mino and Jim Schmidt.
On Monday's show, we'll welcome Meg Deem with the Friends of the Brown County Library to talk about their Give a Kid a Book program.
And Amy Herrick with the Fox Cities Chamber talks about their Excellence in Education Shining Star Awards.
Nightlight with Pete Schwaba.
John Legend, ladies and gentlemen. John, you and I have something in common because your last name is Legend and you're an actual legend. And my last name is Schwabba and I'm an actual Schwabba. So there you go.
No, what is a Schwabba? You have to explain.
I'm a work in progress, but as soon as I figure it out, I'll let you know.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app. You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay. WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.